Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest today is Robert William Fogel, 1993 Nobel Laureate in Economics. Dr. Fogel is the Charles R. Walgreen Distinguished Service Professor of American Institutions at the Graduate School of Business and Director of the Center for Population Economics at the University of Chicago. He is the 2004 Hitchcock Lecturer on the Berkeley campus. Professor Fogel, welcome to Berkeley.
Wonderful to be here.
Where were you born and raised?
I was born and raised in the Bronx, New York City, for Californians who may not have heard of the Bronx.
That's right. Although there are many immigrants here, so some of us have heard. And looking back, how do you think your parents shaped your thinking about the world?
Well, my parents were very loving, very optimistic people, and they gave me an optimistic outlook on life. My father arrived at Ellis Island penniless and in 1922, and by 1929 he saved enough money to open his first business, and by 1939, even though the Depression intervened, he owned a business that employed over 100 people. Mm-hmm. So I'll tell you something that reflected the improvement in the status of the Fogel family. My brother, who was 6 years older than me and 9 years ahead of me in school, was a freshman at City College in New York when I was only 10 years old. Mm-hmm. And I remember he and a bunch of friends having a conversation one night when I was supposed to be asleep. And the topic was, what do you do if you own about a date on a weekend if you only have 10 cents? And the answer was, find a girl who's babysitting. A nickel will get you there and a nickel will bring you back.
That's very good.
By the time I went to school, I was going to Cornell, a private school, and on an allowance that would have staggered my brother. Mm-hmm. In 1936.
And you were going to Cornell in what year?
1944.
And did your father want his sons to go into business?
He was very eager to. One of the big disappointments in his life was that neither my brother nor I wanted to take over the business. And he eventually sold the business when he retired. So he was quite disappointed.
What do you think, is there a common element in what you drew you and your brother to university life?
Well, I was heavily influenced by my brother. He was my hero. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to emulate him when I was growing up. So I don't know. I mean, he was an extremely successful student. He was at the top of his high school class. So I think he just did very well in academic life, first in high school and then in college, and inspired me by his achievements.
Mm-hmm. How do you think the times affected you? You were probably too young to appreciate the Depression, but that's an era in which there's a lot of turbulence. Did that seep in into your consciousness? Not necessarily
telling
us why you chose the academy, but the issues you would look at.
Well, I mean, when I lived through the Depression, I thought it was a golden age. Mm-hmm. Because my family life was so
secure. Yeah.
And I had wonderful teachers who, despite the Depression, had optimistic outlooks. And I remember in third or fourth grade, a teacher saying, in the United States, anyone can be president. So I grew up with the belief that I could be president, too. So I had the notion that there was a lot of opportunity, both from my parents and from my teachers.
Before you went to college, or in the beginning of college, you actually thought about being a scientist, right?
Yes, I went to Stuyvesant High School, which was one of three science high schools in New York City. And my first passion was physical chemistry. I wanted to go to Caltech and study with a man who had won the Nobel Prize for physical chemistry some years earlier. But my mother wouldn't hear of my going 3,000 miles away from home. She wanted me to go to Columbia. And my brother, who I've described in print as the great compromiser, proposed Cornell. I'd be away from home, but still within a day's train ride of the city.
So physical chemistry's loss was economics gain, but what drew you to economics?
What drew me to economics was the great concern in Congress and in the media and among my teachers with that the great unemployment of the Depression would return, and possible ways, mainly through Keynesian solutions, that the government might be able to intervene to prevent it. So it sounded challenging, and I thought I wanted to know more about these economic problems and what you can do about them.
Now, a second part of the story of your career and your work is that you also are a historian, and you bring history and economics together in your work. Help us understand how that came about. What made you bring history along in the work that you did in economics?
Well, I liked history. I used to read history for fun. I had very good history teachers in junior high school and high school who made it a really lively and living field. And then I had the good fortune that my principal teachers, both at the master's degree level and at the PhD level, were very historically oriented, particularly Simon Kuznets, who supervised my dissertation and was the third winner of the Nobel Prize in economics.
Mm-hmm. And were these teachers, did they have a European background? I mean, their sense of history? Because one can say that Americans generally don't have as much of a sense of history.
Simon Kuznets was born in Russia and came here at about age 20. Mm. Got a master's and then a PhD at Columbia University in the late 20s. And worked with Mitchell, the founder of the National Bureau of Economics, who had a very strong historical orientation to economics. And the National Bureau in general has appreciated history as a source of evidence and as a basis for forecasting mm-hmm. likely developments in the economy. So I think the fact that I was with teachers who, although they were economists, valued history mm-hmm. as a basis for forecasting.
Tell us a little about the synergy between history and economics. Is because when one thinks of economics, one thinks of theory.
Yeah, right.
But with history, you often don't associate it with theory. So there must be an interesting play that has really helped you in your work.
Well, I was also very theoretically oriented. Mm-hmm. I had very good theory teachers at Columbia, one of whom was George Stigler, another Nobel Prize winner, and he was the first holder of the chair that I now hold. So he was a mentor both as a teacher and when I came to Chicago as a young faculty member, took an interest in me. So he was very pleased to see how I was combining economic history with theory, and helped to encourage me to develop that approach at the University of Chicago.
I think I read that you wrote this somewhere, that the historical point of view makes you better aware of the evidence you need. Explain that to us.
Well, I think one way to look at it, I mean, if you look at the kinds of problems we're now worried about, we being Congress, the president, the makers of national economic policy, we worry about the fact that the Social Security system may go bankrupt in 30 years, or that Medicare may go bankrupt in a similar time span. Well, if you're going to forecast 30 years in advance, are you just going to do it with today's data? Mm-hmm. Or do you want to see how the demand for health care and the cost of providing it have changed over a substantial period in the past in order to forecast likely trends? So you have to be a historian to be a good forecaster. You have to know what data to look at. And most of our forecasters, even though they're not trained as economic history, have to learn a lot of economic history.
Using the example of Social Security, then it probably becomes important to understand how it came into being and what assumptions were built into the program, which have now changed as our historical situation has changed.
Right. You need to go back into the history in order to know why we have, let's say, the kind of problems we have. Mm-hmm. That is, what was the outlook of the people who designed Social Security in the 1930s and then redesigned it under the Great Society program. So their vision, the vision of the people who were trying to set up a system that would last for a while, is your basis for thinking about, well, what are our problems going to be in the future, mm-hmm. and how do we improve on the current design in order to avoid a crisis sometime in the not too distant future?
And part of the issue there, I guess, is financing, right? The way they chose to finance the system.
Right. Financing is the central issue. It's not that we're too poor a country. We spend, if we take health care, for example, we spend a great deal of our national income on health care, 15%. My forecast is that by 2030 we'll be spending 21%, and I'm relatively on the low end. There are some very notable forecasters who think it's going to be 29%, so nearly a third. Mm-hmm. will be spent on health care. And if you go back to 1929, for example, we only spent 3%. We're much healthier than we were in 1929, but we spend more than five times what we spent then. So the demand for health care is not driven by the fact that we're getting more unhealthy, mm-hmm. but that we're getting richer. Indeed, we're so rich that we need to use only a small fraction of our income for what used to be thought of as the basic necessities of life, food, clothing, and shelter. At the beginning of the 20th century, 75% of all household expenditures went for that, and now it's less than a third. Mm-hmm. And we're eating too much. Mm-hmm. We're eating more food and more expensive food. And a lot of the food is not just food, it's services, because food is now substantially prepared. Most of us have big freezers, and a lot of it is frozen. But even if you buy from the grocery store, if you buy spinach, it's pre-washed. Mm-hmm. In my mother's day, if you bought spinach, the grocer would pick up a bunch of spinach that was one-third sand by weight, wrap it in a newspaper, and my mother spent hours trying to wash the sand out. And even then, the spinach she gave me was a little on the gritty side. So we eat a wider variety of foods that are relatively more expensive in the chain, where we don't eat much grains anymore. We used to be 75% of our calories used to come from grains. And yet, despite all of this, food, clothing, and shelter are under a third of all of our expenditures. So we have a lot of other things to spend it on. And we spend it on education. We spend it on health care. We spend it on early retirement compared to the beginning of the century. And we spend it on a variety of leisure time activities.
I hear you saying that the history then allows you to see the kind of institutional and broad context in which the program originally emerges, but then history helps you see its evolution over time to where we are, and then to project
right.
into the future.
And also how the society that program is supposed to serve has changed.
Right.
How its needs and interests have changed.
So what was the situation of old people at the time of Roosevelt are very different. Now, are you satisfied, or what is your comment on the way this kind of analysis, which gives us a sense of the picture, the whole picture over time, how that information is then used by the people who make policy? In other words, do politicians still tend to get it wrong, you know, once they have all of this information?
I have a very high regard for the people in Congress who specialize in these issues. They are very knowledgeable. They have excellent staffs, and they invite academics to evaluate their proposals and approaches. So I think Congress is very serious. It wants to do a good job on these things. How serious Congress is gets a little distorted by partisan elections, because there's a certain amount of drama mm-hmm. in which you try and emphasize the problems more if you're the party out of power more than in a non-electoral situation. You might be inclined to do. But leaving aside what you might call the theatrics of elections, I think the politicians are very well-informed, serious men who want to make sure that the government serves the population well.
Mm-hmm. Now, another important element of your work is the methodological sophistication that you have brought to these studies. And I think you were an early user of computers to gather this information. And I think I heard you say in your lecture that if the technology hadn't come in to assist you, that the cost would have been so prohibitive that you never could have done some of the work, for example, on aging. Talk a little about that and how, because you've made clear to us the way you brought history and economic theory to the agenda, but also the sophisticated instruments that you had to work with were very important.
Well, we've been studying the aging of the Union Army cohort, the cohort that fought during the Civil War. And that was the first cohort to reach age 65 in the 20th century. So if we're interested in how the process of aging has changed during living memory, that's an important cohort to study.
And there is the data. In other words, the War Department gathered the information about these people.
Yes. The nature of the Union Army pension was such that the average pensioner had a full-scale physical examination about once every 3 years. And those medical records have survived in the National Archives. Mm. Our research team is 50% physicians. Mm. And they've gone over these records, and they said if they were in a rural area and didn't have access to the high-tech facility diagnostic techniques we use today, they could not have done better than these doctors did. So it was absolutely first-rate clinical medicine. And from that, we've been able to learn a great deal about differences in the burden of diseases and in the process of aging. The Union Army cohort aged about 10 years more rapidly than we did. For example, in my cohort, the average age of onset of arthritis is about age 65. Mm-hmm. In the Union Army cohort, it was about age 54.
Hmm.
So we've pushed back the age of onset of arthritis by 11 years. And the same thing is true with heart disease, with respiratory disease, and so on. All these things start later. But not only that, the proportion who ever get these diseases is about a third less than it used to be. And once you get it, we have excellent interventions. We have drug interventions, we have other surgical interventions that are effective. And they may not extend our life, but they greatly improve the quality of life.
Let's talk a little about the work that you've done on aging. So what did bringing this data to bear to the questions you're interested about aging, what did you conclude, basically, about the causes of this differences in the onset of these chronic illnesses?
We concluded that we should apply for another grant.
That's good.
And we have.
Yeah.
So we're still working on it.
Yeah.
We have some conclusions.
Yeah.
But I think most of the research is ahead of us.
Right.
And we've been invited by the National Institute of Aging to engage in a parallel project, which we call Explaining the Decline in Disabilities During the 20th Century, which means that the data that we already have is not adequate to answer all the questions we'd like. It was adequate to identify that there had been a change.
Yeah.
But not adequate to identify why.
Mm-hmm.
Nevertheless, we have some preliminary hypotheses. Mm-hmm. And I spoke about those in my first Hitchcock lecture. We believe that the principal explanation for the increase in life expectancy and the reduction in disabilities during the course of the 20th century is the cleaning up of the environment, that the exposure to very severe health, to use an epidemiologist's word, health insults, were very severe and did long-term damage to the physiology of the people who were exposed to them.
And this is at birth? I mean, in the early stages of
it
life?
It includes in utero.
Yeah.
But it's throughout the life cycle.
Okay.
But the years, the early childhood are the most sensitive years, when organs are still developing. Even if no new cells are being added, the cells are getting bigger. That's why we get bigger.
Mm-hmm.
Our cells get larger. And in some systems, like the central nervous system, new cells keep getting added throughout the developmental ages. Now, that means if you have processes which interfere with cellular formation, you may have deficits in the organs that are not literally apparent, but take the form of earlier breakdown.
Mm-hmm.
And there have been a number of studies in the United States, in several countries in Europe, and in India, among others, that reveal a high correlation between characteristics of the fetus at birth and characteristics of development during the first year of life that predict such things as the odds of having high blood pressure or type 2 diabetes or chronic respiratory disease in your 50s and 60s.
So is one preliminary conclusion that one might reach that health expenditures devoted to early child care could be an important issue, could be an important way to address some of these problems?
Yes, that's a definite policy implication that's arisen from this work. Not just early child care, but prenatal care as well.
Mm-hmm.
So the prenatal period and early childhood period, investments in good health, including counseling of mothers, getting women who smoke to stop smoking, getting women who drink to stop drinking during pregnancy,
mm-hmm.
and to eat appropriately, all those things will lead to healthier fetuses and healthier infants and healthier life throughout the developmental ages and into middle and old age.
I get the sense as I listen to you that this is, your work really transcends economics and history because it's really quite interdisciplinary in terms of all the fields of knowledge that come to bear in reaching these kinds of conclusions.
That's right. I spend more of my time these days with doctors than I do with economists.
Yeah. Yeah.
Although, don't get me wrong, I love economics.
That's good. You use the term in your lecture and in your book, the theory of techno-physio-evolution.
Right.
Talk a little about that, because that really points to the insights that are coming from all these different fields about what has created the conditions for this change in people's health.
Well, one of the things that we've done in our search for evidence bearing on the explanation for the enormous increase in life expectancy over the past three centuries has been to identify physiological changes that may have explanatory power. And in this connection, one of the most important measures is a class of measures called anthropometric measures. They're physical characteristics of the body, such as height, sitting height, the size of the amount of fat that you have on your body, the amount of lean body mass, a measure called the body mass index, which is weight standardized for height. And these things have shown to be highly correlated. The improvement in these anthropometric measures are highly correlated with the increase in life expectancy and the reduction in morbidity over time and over the life cycle. A person born in 1950 has twice the life expectancy, more than twice, 2.5 times the life expectancy of someone who was born in 1700. So over 300 years, we've doubled life expectancy. We've increased weight. We've increased average weight by 50%. And we've added nearly a foot to stature. So we're, and what goes along with these difference in these external measures are stronger lungs, stronger hearts, improved respiration, stronger electrical signals across membranes. So in every respect that we've been able to measure, and we can do some of the measuring with these high techniques because unfortunately there are still some people who are as badly off in physiology because of malnutrition and exposure to disease in some very poor countries as the French were before the French Revolution.
I'm curious, you know, as I listen to you talk, clearly methodology is important, history is important, economic theory is important, but I'm curious, over the lifetime of your career, you've addressed some really big projects, just a few to, you know, slavery, railroads, aging, and try to locate them and understand what these phenomena were in their broader institutional context. What drew you to these subjects? I mean, is it something in your background? Is it the evidence that it's available? Just what interests you? I would be interested in the origins of the topics that you selected.
Yeah, well, a lot of them are accidental. The general trend is not accidental. But when I was sitting in Simon Kuznets's class on economic development across countries and over time, at one point he said one of the most important factors in economic growth and development was the invention of the railroad, but no one has really studied it. And I said, oh, I like railroads, and actually I had done my master's thesis on the Union Pacific Railroads. I already knew something about it. So I decided to write my PhD dissertation on railroads and American economic growth. I got into the study of slavery as an accident. The precipitating factor in this case was the editing of a book called the reinterpretation of American economic history, which was supposed to bring together about 30 of the best articles in Queometrics, that is, in works of economic history using pretty high-tech statistics and econometrics. And we divided the book into 9 sections, one of which was on the economics of slavery. And Stan Engelman and I wrote a rather long introduction to it. The work up until that date had focused on whether slavery was profitable or not, and whether the slave South was growing more or less rapidly than the North. And in the introduction, we said, well, what issues about slavery should the Queometricians take on next? And we said, well, they ought to show how much less efficient slavery was than free agriculture, and to emphasize that theme, we thought we'd do a little back-of-the-envelope calculation. Mm-hmm. And we thought that the back-of-the-envelope calculation would show that slavery was at least 50% less efficient. But when we did it, it turned out to be 6% more efficient. Mm. And we were startled. We said, boy, we really messed that one up. Mm-hmm. And we started looking at it a little bit in more detail and redid it more carefully. At that point, we would hope just it was less than one. Mm-hmm. We thought maybe people had been too sanguine in thinking that it was a 50% difference. But when we redid it, it turned out to be 36% more. So at that stage, we applied for law and received a large NSF grant to study slavery. And one of the things we had to study was the demography of slavery, because the health and longevity of slaves was a factor in how productive, mm-hmm. and how you measured productivity. And it was there that we got interested in differential mortality trends. And we began to realize that we knew very little about trends in mortality in the United States before the 1890s. And we were aware that the Mormons had collected genealogical data, and that was available in Salt Lake City, with which you could reconstruct the pattern of change in mortality. Mm-hmm. And so we began a project on the improvements in life expectancy from about 1710 on. And that laid the basis, those experiences, the creation of those data sets, the recognition that we now had high-speed computers that enabled us to get data that nobody, that we knew was there, but nobody thought was usable. But with the appearance of high-speed computers and later on laptops, so you can actually take them into the archives and input the data at very low costs and process it at relatively low costs, we calculated. We received in 1991 a grant to begin the study of the aging process in the Union Army. And we calculated what, and it was a $3 million grant, and we calculated what would it have cost us to have done that project with the technology of 1978. And the answer was about $300 million. We would have needed a special bill through Congress. It was way outside mm-hmm. the parameters of even big grants at the National Science Foundation or the National Institutes of Health. So the change in technology made it possible to go through massive data retrieval. And in the case of the Union Army sample, in order to get a lifetime picture of the changes in health over the life from early childhood to death, we had to link together information from 20 different data sources. Mm-hmm. And to describe that life cycle pattern, including all of the health information, mm-hmm. takes 15,000 variables. Mm. When I first started using computers, or let's not say when I first started, when I was using computers in the mid to late 1970s, 5,000 variables with maybe 5,000 observations with maybe 50 variables was thought to be the outer limit of what you can handle. So here we had 40,000 observations with 15,000 variables on each observation. And I won't say it was a snap, but it was doable.
So the long-term trend is that one problem leads you to another, and the technology coming on board allows you to do things you could not have done in the first instance.
At every stage in our work on long-term changes in health and longevity, at every stage we were pushing the limits of technology. Mm-hmm. And our main problem was to convince our peers that it could be done. Mm-hmm. They were all convinced it was a good idea, mm-hmm. but they had to be convinced it could actually be done. And within the expenditure limits that we were proposing.
And I guess some of these results, like the results on slavery, were pretty controversial. So it's a combination of what the evidence shows on the one hand being controversial, but also the controversy aroused by saying, well, we want to go in this direction. And
they were very controversial within our own research group. Mm-hmm. There were times when I thought that Stan was nuts, and there were times that he thought that I was nuts. And our graduate research assistants thought we were both nuts.
I see.
Although sometimes they were ahead of us. But it was so contrary to received wisdom.
On slavery now.
On slavery. That it was very difficult to... When we got our first results, we were so dubious about it that we delayed publication for 2 years, trying to falsify the result. Mm-hmm. And we only published it after 2 years when we couldn't break our own findings.
When one thinks of creativity or of the work of Nobel laureates, you think of that eureka moment where suddenly things are put together. Is that what you've experienced in your career, or is it more the initial choices about directions that you want to go that are really more important? What is the best description of the most exciting moments in your career?
Well, there are a lot of eureka moments, but it's not eureka or I found it. Mm-hmm. It's eureka. It's just the opposite from the way we've all thought it would be.
I see. Also,
a lot of the most, if you take the slavery, some of the most important turning points were discoveries by our graduate students, mm-hmm. that we never dreamed of. They would just give us a result, and I'd say, can't be true, you must have done something wrong. Mm-hmm. And I only gradually realized that it was my priors that were wrong. Their work was right. Mm-hmm. So we got started on tracks that we never anticipated, because it's very collective. It's a research group. It's not a lonely scholar, mm-hmm. with a light suddenly coming on. It's collective research, takes a lot of labor, takes a lot of different skills. Nobody has all those skills. programming skills, analytical skills, historical skills, statistical skills. And so different people are contributing different kinds of expertise, and they all are part of the research program. And I don't know of anyone who participated in our research groups who at the end of it could say, gee, well, I really knew that at the beginning.
Mm-hmm. So then how would you characterize the people who do well in the kind of work we're talking about? Are there particular skills or characteristics that are good to
hard,
have?
Hard work.
Patience.
Hard work, patience, are willing to put up with tedium because, you know, at the end, something interesting might come out of it. But in order to get to that really interesting or surprising thing, there's a lot of tedium you have to overcome.
If students were watching, were to watch this tape, how would you advise them to prepare for the future, you know, in the kinds of fields that you've worked in?
Just study the basic disciplines, the basic. There is sort of, if you're in economics, get the main foundations of economics, the theoretical, the statistical, and the empirical skills that we train PhD economists in. If you're a historian, learn the history of the period very thoroughly. Take advantage of quantitative data that may be available. It's not the only form of data, but is an important additional form. And everyone uses word processors, so the computer isn't as frightening as it was 30 years ago when it seemed like some mysterious black box. Mm-hmm. Many students have, in history, have picked up the kinds of skills that you need, let's say, to do a study in demographic history or in changes in voting behavior in political history, or changes in the standard of living of the lower classes. Those things, those skills are now widely available, and there are many people in history departments who have those skills and can convey it to their students.
I infer from your writings, some of which I've read, a small portion of them that I've read, that you think writing is also important, clear writing.
Writing is probably the single most important skill. Mm-hmm. The ability to communicate, that's what writing is. And in some fields, they're so technical that the writing consists of a series of equations that can go on one page, and the only words are we begin with, and we have lemma 1, lemma 2, lemma 3. All that goes in between it is in Greek. And then at the end you say QED. That's it. There are fields of mathematics where you don't have to write well, although many of my friends in mathematics are more skilled in humane discipline than, let's say, social scientists are. So people in the sciences and in mathematics are a very broad, humane, and social scientific interests. That I think is part of American scientific culture.
And one final question, building on all that you've studied, where do you think the interesting problems are going to be in this cross between history and economics?
You know, I'm so focused on the economics and biodemography of aging. that I'm not a good person to ask that question too broadly. I do not follow economic history in the way that I once did. So I still have a lot of friends, and I speak to them. So every few months, they bring me up to date on something that's exciting or new. But I can tell you a lot about what's interesting in aging. The central problem that needs to be answered is, will we be able to constrain the increase in the demand for health care? A related question is, what is the likely what will the likely pattern of age-specific morbidity and disability rates be over the next several decades? I think there's general agreement that for most conditions, they're going to become milder, be pushed off further in time in terms of onset, but not necessarily in all conditions. There is some evidence that the prevalence of diabetes is increasing. And for younger people, there have been some increases in asthma. So within the framework of a general improvement in health, there can be reverses. And indeed, everything can be reversed. Of course, these are not genetic changes. They're environmental changes. So a worsening of the environment for any one of a variety of reasons can cause serious setbacks. As I said, I'm an optimist. I'm an optimist from early childhood on. And I believe that we're going to get healthier. I believe that I've written in the book that I just published, I forecast that life expectancy during the current century would increase by another 30 years. Mm-hmm. So that life expectancy of people who are undergraduates here will end up, the average length of life will end up being close to 100.
Well, on that very positive note, I want to thank you, Professor Fogel, for coming to Berkeley to give the Hitchcock Lectures and taking the time to be on the show. Thank you very much.
Thank you for inviting me.
And thank you very much for joining us for this conversation with history.